Good day. Welcome to another episode of the Audible Local Ledger Reads to the Blind podcast. You can get more information at audiblelocalledger.org. Stay tuned for today's reading.
Hi, I'm Libby, and I'll be reading you today's Cape Cod Times, dated Friday, March 29th, 2024. The weather outlook continues to be much of the same. Today will be windy with periods of rain, but highs will reach almost 50. Tonight, the lows will dip down back into the mid-30s, and the rain will start to let up. The weekend looks beautiful. With Saturday the best, highs will reach 55. It will be sunny and breezy. On Easter Sunday, the highs will be nearly 50. Some clouds will return, but we'll still see some sunshine. By special request from a few of our faithful listeners, we now present the lottery numbers. For Thursday's midday drawing of the numbers game, we have numbers 9, 6, 2, and 4. The evening drawing that night were numbers 0, 7, 3, and 8. For Thursday's mass cash drawing, we have numbers 13, 14, 19, 20, and 32. Wednesday's Powerball numbers were 37, 46, 57, 60, 66, and the extra ball of number 8. And finally, for the Mega Millions drawing, we have numbers 7, 11, 22, 29, 38, and the extra ball of 4. And that was for Tuesday, when the jackpot went to a winner in New Jersey, and it was more than $1 billion. The lead story on page 1 of today's newspaper is headlined Official: Cape Cod Canal Bridge Collapse Unlikely. Structures have similar design, but different support systems. By Walker Armstrong of the Cape Cod Times. Following the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore on Tuesday morning, officials in Massachusetts have been scrambling to assess the safety and security of the dozens of bridges traversing navigable waterways statewide. The $4.5 billion replacement of the Bourne and Sagamore bridges looms on the horizon, raising questions about whether a similar collapse could happen to the pair of octogenarian bridges. The Cape Cod Canal bridges were designed and built in the 1930s by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which still owns and maintains them today. The bridges initially saw 1 million crossings annually, with that figure shooting up to nearly 38 million today, according to the Cape Cod Commission. That level of traffic is about the same as the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco, which is about 6 times the length and twice the width. Jonathan Gulliver, the Massachusetts Department of Transportation Highway Administrator, said in a Tuesday press conference the canal bridges are of a similar design type to the Francis Scott Key, but have very different support systems. Similar to a number of other bridges that are over navigable waterways, the pier, so the structure that got hit by that ship in Baltimore, was a pier that was in the navigation channel, Gulliver said. My understanding is both the Bourne and the Sagamore, as well as the Tobin, those piers are all outside of the navigation channel, and so a ship would run aground before they hit those piers and caused any structural damage. The Tobin Bridge carries Route 1 over the Mystic River, connecting Boston and Chelsea. Much like the Francis Scott Key Bridge, the canal bridges do not have protective fenders sheltering their piers. What happened at the Francis Scott Key Bridge? Around 1:30 a.m. on Tuesday, a cargo ship struck a column of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore, which carried Interstate 695 over the Patapsco River. The bridge collapsed within seconds of the strike. The ship sent out a mayday before the collision and gave officials time to stop cars from driving onto the bridge, according to USA Today. As of Wednesday afternoon, crews stopped searching for the construction workers believed to be on the bridge when it collapsed. Has a ship ever hit a Cape Cod Canal bridge? In 2016, a 131-foot-tall Norwegian cruise ship called the Viking Star clipped the railroad bridge in Buzzards Bay, on the western end of the Cape Cod Canal. The vertical lift bridge, which stands 135 feet above the water, was scraped by an antenna atop the cruise ship. Although some paint was lost, all three canal bridges, the railroad bridge and to the east, the Bourne and Sagamore bridges, were inspected after the incident and found undamaged, according to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers at the time. During a Tuesday meeting with state officials and various news agencies, Governor Maura Healey said the Cape Cod Canal bridges have been deemed structurally deficient, a technical term meaning the bridges are safe to drive and traverse over, but still have other deteriorations or other flaws. Structurally deficient doesn't mean unsafe, Healey said, because what happens is when there is that designation, there was work immediately done to ensure safe passage, but it doesn't take away from the fact that we actually need to have these bridges replaced. What happened in Baltimore might be an extraordinary case, unlikely to occur on the canal, U.S. Representative William Keating, a Democrat of Massachusetts, said in an email to the Times. The most important thing to do now is allow the National Transportation Safety Board and other officials to determine why the specific incident happened and learn how to prevent it from ever happening again, Keating said. Then we need to take whatever preventative measures, if there are any determined by the official investigation, and apply them in Massachusetts and across the country. Offshore wind projects rebid for contracts. By Heather McCarron of the Cape Cod Times. Three familiar offshore wind projects and one new one have emerged as contenders for contracts through the new Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island multi-state solicitation for offshore wind power. Wednesday was the deadline for developers to submit proposals for consideration under New England's largest wind power solicitation to date. Offshore wind developers Avangrid Renewables, South Coast Wind Energy, and Vineyard Offshore all submitted bids. The power cable landings planned for or considered for Cape Cod beaches, as outlined in the new submissions, are ones already announced by the companies. In Falmouth at Dowses Beach, in Osterville, and at Craigville Beach in Centerville. Cancellation of contracts last fall. Avangrid and South Coast last fall canceled previous contracts in Massachusetts and Connecticut, citing economic reasons that made those agreements no longer financially viable. They're seeking better terms under their new bids. Both companies are presenting iterations of their earlier projects in lease areas south of Martha's Vineyard, Park City Wind, Commonwealth Wind, and South Coast Wind. Vineyard Offshore is putting forth a brand new project eyed for the easternmost lease area 29 miles south of Nantucket. The company is a subsidiary of Copenhagen Infrastructure Partners, which shares ownership with Avangrid of Vineyard Wind 1, an 806-megawatt project that has 5 of 62 planned turbines now fully operational and sending power to the grid via Covell Beach in Centerville. The Healey-Driscoll administration will review bids over the coming months and coordinate with Connecticut and Rhode Island to evaluate multi-state projects that would increase benefits for the region, lower costs, and enhance project viability, Massachusetts Energy Resources Commissioner Elizabeth Mahoney said in a statement. Decisions are expected to be released on August 9th. Avangrid, a member of the Iberdrola Group, on Wednesday, submitted multiple proposals for the tri-state solicitation, both to the states as a group as well as individually to each state. The company has renamed its previous projects, Park City Wind and Commonwealth Wind, as New England Wind 1 and New England Wind 2. Combined, the projects would deliver a little more than 1,800 megawatts to the ISO New England grid that brings power to the region. Avangrid Vice President of Development for Offshore Wind, Ken Kemmel, on Wednesday, said the company is promoting its New England Wind 1 project, formerly Park City Wind, as the one closest to putting shovels in the ground. For that reason, one of the company's proposals submitted on Wednesday is for New England Wind 1 only, allowing the states to choose it individually because of its immediacy. With nearly all local, state, and federal permits in hand, all interconnection rights secured, and a project labor agreement signed with a skilled local union workforce, Avangrid is ready to go, Avangrid CEO Pedro Azagra said in a statement. New England Wind 1 would deliver 791 megawatts, which is less than the 804 megawatts originally proposed. It has to do with the grid and what the capacity is of the grid, Kimmel explained. This is something we work through carefully with Eversource. Avangrid's second proposal combines New England Wind 1 with New England Wind 2, formerly called Commonwealth Wind, into a single bid. Like the New England Wind 1 project, New England Wind 2 would bring ashore slightly less power, about 1,079 megawatts, than the originally proposed 1,200 megawatts. New England Wind 2, which is still proposed to land at Dowses Beach in Centerville, is only offered as a combined project with New England Wind 1 to capture important economics of scale and support significant grid upgrades, according to Avangrid. Kimmel said if the New England Wind 1 only bid is selected, the company would expect to rebid for the second project during a later wind power solicitation. He said some highlights of the company's plans include an already signed labor agreement for New England Wind 1 and an associated plan for a new offshore wind marshalling port in Salem. The company is poised to provide $30 million in upfront investment and $100 million in lease payments to jumpstart that development. What is Vineyard Offshore planning? Vineyard Offshore is proposing a 1,200 megawatt project with a target of becoming operational in 2031. It would make landfall in New London, Connecticut, and interconnect with the New England power grid in Montville, Connecticut. Like Avangrid, Vineyard Offshore similarly submitted proposals to each state separately, as well as to the three states together. As part of the bid, the company is also highlighting investments in the Salem Offshore Wind Terminal, planned to be the staging site for wind turbine installation, providing hundreds of union jobs and boosting an emerging offshore wind workforce and supply chain on the North Shore. Vineyard Offshore additionally plans to source secondary steel components for foundations, internal and external platforms, boat landings, and more, from Riggs Distler & Company, working at its current operation in the Port of Providence or at a new site under development in East Providence. Our project will deliver more than $2 billion in economic benefits, create opportunities for workers and local businesses, and build on partnerships with local governments, organizations, and institutions across all three states. And we have the local support to show for it, said Vineyard Offshore CEO Alyssa Barton in a statement. What is South Coast Wind 1? South Coast Wind Energy, owned by OW Ocean Winds, put in a bid Wednesday for its 1,200-megawatt South Coast Wind Project 1. It would land in Portsmouth, Rhode Island, and connect to the New England grid at Brayton Point in Somerset, with an aim to deliver first power by 2030. The company has the capacity to produce up to 2,400 megawatts in its lease area, located more than 30 miles south of the Vineyard and 20 miles south of Nantucket. For the current wind solicitation, though, the company chose to focus on bidding its first 1,200 megawatts because South Coast Wind 1 is well advanced in its permitting at both the federal and state levels, said South Coast Wind Director of External Affairs Rebecca Ullman in an email Wednesday. The company has a host community agreement with Portsmouth, Rhode Island, to land the first 1,200 megawatts there for routing to Brayton Point, with an option for the remaining 1,200 megawatts if needed. At present, Falmouth remains an alternative option for eventually landing and connecting the second 1,200 megawatts to the grid. However, due to uncertainty around ISO New England grid capacity and the extent and timing of necessary grid upgrades in Falmouth, South Coast Wind is looking closely at Brayton Point for delivery of the full lease area capacity of 2,400 megawatts, Ullman said. If Falmouth is ultimately pursued, though, a landing site on Worcester Avenue at Falmouth Heights would be the preferred landfall, according to Ullman. Central Park and Kite Park have also been investigated. Trailer Park Face Growing Rent Crisis, by Brendan Nordstrom of Boston University State House Program. If Jeannie Warish won the Powerball, she would buy Rocky Knoll Estates in Taunton. Warish, a 10-year resident of the manufactured housing community, more commonly known as mobile home or trailer parks, doesn't play the Powerball, but she and other residents have long wished they could own the 158-lot park. We'd buy the park, and then we'd be able to keep the rents down, because any profit is not going to someone else but back into the park, Warish said. That's a dream for a lot of us. The residents of Rocky Knoll Estates have faced yearly rent increases. The monthly rent in 2013, when Warish moved in, was $401. In 2024, it's $696 per month. Residents of manufactured housing communities own the house itself, but pay rent on the land underneath. As Warish put it, paying nearly $700 for a parking space with utilities is a struggle. High rent and neglect. Across the Commonwealth, residents of manufactured housing communities are facing high rent increases and neglect from the investors that own the parks. Both residents and lawmakers are pushing for solutions, such as rent stabilization, to alleviate this pressure. In Massachusetts, just recently, it's been a serious issue, said Deborah Weinowitz, the Association Director of New England Resident-Owned Communities. Rents do have to go up sometimes just because of the cost, but you've got to be fair. There are about 250 manufactured housing parks in Massachusetts, serving 35,000 residents. The homes are built on chassis and brought into parks on wheels. However, moving these mobile homes can cost up to $13,000. Oversight Board pitched as one solution. Representative James Hawkins, a Democrat from Attleboro, recently introduced a bill intended to stabilize rent in these communities, allowing cities or towns to adopt oversight boards. Owners of manufactured housing communities would not be allowed to raise the rent by more than the chained consumer price index for all urban consumers, a measure of the monthly change of prices, unless the board determines it will yield a fair net operating income, according to the bill. What it means is that anything that these owners do has to be in compliance with existing state law so they can't gouge their tenants, Hawkins said. There's no place for residents to go, so whatever level of protection we can give them, we have to do it. If the bill were to pass, the onus would shift onto the city or town to establish a rent stabilization board. Hawkins said Taunton and Attleboro were two cities that would adopt the board. Trailer parks seen as piggy banks. In recent years, investors have seen manufactured housing communities as a growing form of passive income, according to the New Yorker. A sign that an investment firm has bought a manufactured housing community is a dramatic spike in lot rent. Wealthy people who have resources to invest are often advised by their financial planners to invest in manufactured housing. That investment is sometimes described as the piggy bank for growing your wealth, said Representative Carol Doherty, a Democrat from Taunton. There's a great crisis that is growing. What happens when residents purchase their parks? Some parks in Massachusetts have become cooperative, resident-owned communities, utilizing the Commonwealth's right of first refusal law. This law allows tenants to purchase the park if it goes for sale, so long as at least 51% of the community approves the purchase. ROC USA is one organization that helps these communities secure financing and organize the park's structure to control rent, avoid unfair evictions, and protect against liability. There are 28 resident-owned communities in Massachusetts that are run like a small town, Weinowitz said. These parks set up rules and bylaws committees, boards of directors, and a finance committee, as well as meet annually to vote on a budget and any rent increases. Seniors can age in place, Weinowitz said. I'd like to see more ROCs for that protection, and I'd like to see new ones built. However, if a community doesn't go up for sale, they are at the mercy of their owners, Weinowitz said. On Cape Cod, Pawcasset Mobile Home Park off Barlow's Landing in Bourne was engulfed in a years-long legal battle where both Crown Communities LLC and the residents Pawcasset Park Association wanted ownership of the park. Crown, which owns and operates mobile home parks nationwide, entered a purchase and sale agreement with owner Philip Austin as trustee of the Charles W. Austin Trust on November 15, 2019, for $3.8 million in an all-cash sale. Notice was sent to residents 5 days later. Under the state's right of first refusal statute, park residents submitted a matching bid working with New England resident-owned communities, which partnered with the Cooperative Development Institute. The organizations help residents to both secure ownership of their mobile home parks and get loans to match private bidders and cover any capital projects needed on the site. A Barnstable Superior Court judge ruled in 2022 that the association fell short in fulfilling the requirements needed to win the park, which included having signatures from at least 51% of the residents. The matter has since been appealed to the Massachusetts Appeals Court. According to the assessor's office, the property is still owned by the Charles W. Austin Trust. In Wareham, residents of Royal Crest Mobile Home Community Park learned a private investor was eyeing their community for purchase. In 2022, Legacy Communities, an Arizona investment company which owns and operates dozens of manufactured housing communities in the U.S., submitted an unsolicited offer of $12.1 million to buy the 55-plus senior community. Residents formed a cooperative and submitted their own offer for the park. With help from Cooperative Development Institute and resident-owned communities. The $12.1 million came together from private lenders, state funds, and support from ROC USA's Community Development Financial Institution subsidiary, ROC USA Capital. For the first time, the Massachusetts Department of Housing and Community Development offered affordable housing trust funds to this sort of affordable housing endeavor. Today, Royal Crest is now the 28th resident-owned manufactured home community in Massachusetts. Lawyers for Civil Rights is an organization also fighting rent increases. In January, LCR issued a cease and desist letter to the landlord of two central Massachusetts manufactured housing communities, American Mobile Home Park and Whispering Pine Estates, citing exorbitant rent increases and dangerous and unsanitary conditions, according to a press release. Most of the communities are at the whim of the rent increase, Overlock said. Manufactured housing has been designated low-income affordable housing for a long time now, and when you get to a point where the rents are no longer affordable, you price these people out. Many manufactured housing communities in Massachusetts are senior citizen communities, restricted to residents 55 and older. Many of these residents are on a fixed income due to pensions and Social Security, making the increases more difficult to keep up with. These increases can lead residents to cut down on food or medication to avoid eviction, Winowitz said. If Hawkins' bill doesn't pass and no progress is made, Overlock fears the residents will have to abandon their homes or live on the streets. There won't be any place for these people to live, Overlock said. Cities are going to have to come up with a plan with some kind of affordable housing for them. Stereotypes of trailer parks. Winowitz said manufactured housing communities being overlooked is a 50-year-old struggle due to the stereotypes that surround them. People have to stop looking at facts and figures and start looking at the people behind it, Warish said. We're not giving up at all. No matter what happens with these bills, we're not going away. The bill is in the legislature's Housing Committee until April. If it advances, it would go to the House Ways and Means Committee and a full House vote before going to the Senate. Hawkins said there's no opposition to the legislation, but said it was up to him to ensure the issue gets visibility. These people don't want to leave their homes. They all poured their life savings into them, Overlock said. This is the rest of their lives. This home that they bought was a piece of land that they can sit on their porches and have their own little peace and serenity. Bourne may remove land protections to build fire station, by Paul Gately, special to the Cape Cod Times. Dateline Bourne. Now that another MacArthur Boulevard address is ruled out as a suitable Southside Firehouse location, the site search committee is focusing on the white pine forested tract north of the Shore Road ball field at Monument Beach. The Southside Fire Station Building Committee accepted the recommendation of Town Administrator Marlene McCollum on March 12th and unanimously decided the town property off Shore Road is suitable for fire station construction. That night, the Select Board voted to move the proposal forward toward town meeting while demanding extensive background information be quickly compiled for public consumption. Both panels cite a public safety necessity and realize the site searches going back to last year have come full circle. The Shore Road location was initially and quickly ruled out of consideration in 2023. Officials were concerned the station there would impinge on town and state-protected conservation land. During the site panel and select board discussion, there was no mention of the environmental value the wooded property presents. The proposed station site is under the control of the Conservation Commission and under state protection by the Massachusetts Environmental Affairs Office. If the commission, which manages a land steward program to conserve open spaces, unanimously decides the protected land is relinquishable, McCollum will prepare a 2024 warrant article. A two-thirds majority vote at a town meeting would then be needed to proceed with a station project. In addition, the town would then have to file state legislation to remove the property from its protected state status and find other environmental acreage to mitigate the property's loss to development. This mitigation would have to be of equal or more environmental value than that next to the ball field, McCollum told the site panel. This is a laborious process. State legislative approval could take from 3 months to 2 years, she said. A key part of the legislation would involve the town arguing that no other suitable firehouse site could be identified south of the canal. Select Board Chair Mary Jane Mastrangelo said this aspect of the proposal is a critical element. Fire Chief David Cody said the property is a good location for gauging appropriate fire and rescue calls south of the canal. He said 50% of all department calls for assistance come from the south side, and 35% of that volume is from Prakasset and Katomet. Mastrangelo says much preparation and due diligence are needed before the site panel visits the conservation panel, possibly in early April. She said background information must be presented in a document showing all recent site options explored and items listed as to why the locations proved unsuitable. She also said the proposed site is next to a residential area, something that McCollum earlier in the day said still needs to be addressed. We've reached the halfway point of our program, and regular listeners are aware that at this stage of our broadcast, we move to the obituaries. Our first obituary is for Carolyn Turnbull. Dateline, Orleans. Carolyn Lynn Turnbull, age 85, died March 22nd in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Lynn was born on December 22, 1938, in Brooklyn, New York, and raised in Hempstead, New York, by her parents Albert and Carolyn Van Tassel. She is survived by her husband of 63 years, James Turnbull, and their three children, six grandchildren, and her brother David of West Islip. Lynn attended Elmira College and received her master's degree in teaching from Columbia University. She was a math teacher for over 30 years at multiple schools in New York, including Fox Lane High School, Yorktown High School, and Mahopac Middle School. Lynn was considered an equal partner in the first family of Yorktown Lacrosse, along with her husband, since the day he started the program in 1965. Lynn was also a fierce supporter of her children's sports teams and rarely missed a game, no matter the location. After retiring from teaching, she split time between Orleans and Chapel Hill, as well as traveling all over the country and the world with her husband by her side. Lynn continued to give back to the game she loved and dedicated her time as a scorekeeper for hundreds of lacrosse games in New York and North Carolina. Over the years, she was both a mentor and an occasional critic of lacrosse officials, with her quick wit and no-nonsense attitude at the scorekeeper's table. Lynn was also an avid quilter, knitter, and craft person, always making presents for her children, grandchildren, and nieces and nephews. Lynn combined these skills with her passion for charity as she sewed thousands of quilts and stuffed bears for children in the hospitals of Cape Cod and North Carolina. Lynn leaves behind many friends and family who have described her as a consummate hostess, who was always willing to open her home to old and new friends, and who will miss her homemade strawberry jam and world-famous chocolate chip cookies. A celebration of life will be held in the future. Donations can be made in her honor to Project Linus in Belton, Missouri. Anne N. Dodge, Dateline, Manchester by the Sea. Anne N. Dodge, age 73, of Manchester by the Sea, died on Monday, March 18th. Born in Boston, she was the daughter of the late Roger and Mary Windor Nordblom and beloved wife to the late Stephen B. Dodge. Anne graduated from Williams College with a BFA in English and worked at the Bank of Boston, where she met Steve. She served on the board of University of Vermont Middlesex School and as president of the board at Brookwood School. She was a dedicated member of St. John's Episcopal Church in Beverly Farms and was committed to philanthropy with a special interest in scholarships, animal protection, and land conservation. Anne was known for her love of family and spirited approach to life. She was a loving wife, a devoted mother to her three children, and a proud Nana Anna to her five beloved grandchildren. Her friends were dear to her. Her dogs were family to her. And throughout her life, her faith in God was a beacon for her. Anne was passionate about outdoor activities, including playing tennis, skiing, riding, sailing, and hiking. She loved art and was an avid photographer with her camera always in hand. Painting beautiful watercolors became her creative outlet later in life. She loved traveling with family and friends and was especially connected to Vermont and Cape Cod. Throughout her life, she loved being with people, gathering everyone together. Anne passed surrounded by loved ones. Anne is survived by her two sons, one daughter, two brothers, and two sisters, five grandchildren. In addition to her parents, she is predeceased by her loving husband, Stephen B. Dodge. Anne's memorial service will be at St. John Episcopal Church on Hale Street in Beverly Farms on Friday, April 5th at 2:30 p.m. Relatives and friends are invited to attend. In lieu of flowers, please send donations to the MSPCA in honor of Anne. Arrangements by the Campbell Funeral Home on Cabot Street in Beverly. For information, directions, and condolences, please go to the website of Campbell Funeral. Ruth Ann Coyle, Dateline, Yarmouth. Ruth Ann Coyle, age 70, of South Yarmouth, passed away at her home on March 20th after a long, valiant battle with chronic illness. She is predeceased by her husband, Francis Coyle, mother, Susan Passaro Johnson, and father, Michael Johnson, and her brother, Michael. She leaves behind her daughter, sister-in-law, niece, and other many family members, along with her lifelong friends, Maggie and Leah. Ruth grew up in Brighton, attended St. Columby School, then Newman Preparatory School and Radcliffe College. She moved to the Cape in 1992, where she had a small house cleaning business called Cobwebs. Ruth loved Cape Cod, and it was her childhood dream to live here. She loved to read, music, her friends and family, and her church, St. Pius, where she served as an usher. Visiting hours will be Monday, April 1st from 10:30 until 12:30 at Chapman Funerals and Cremations on Long Pond Road in South Yarmouth, followed by a funeral mass at St. Pius X Church in Yarmouth at 1 p.m. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to St. Pius Church. Notes of comfort may be made to Ruth's family at ChapmanFuneral.com. Returning to the news, we have a story that's headlined, Bronze Statue Planned for Dog Who Inspired Boston Marathon Runners, by Jesse Collings of the Metro West Daily News, Dateline Ashland. Spencer, a golden retriever who inspired thousands of Boston Marathon runners as they made their way down West Union Street, or Route 135, in the early stages of the race, will be immortalized this weekend with a statue near his regular viewing spot. The bronze statue of Spencer will be unveiled Saturday at 11 Franklin Road. The statue was crowdfunded on GoFundMe, with nearly $40,000 raised for its construction. Spencer died in February 2023 at the age of 13 years and 6 months. When he first passed away, there was a huge outcry of support for a statue being placed on the route, and we thought that would be great, but statues are not free, said Rich Powers, a Holliston resident who was Spencer's owner. A couple of volunteers from the Boston Marathon came forward to put together a committee to help raise the funds. The sculpture was completed by Canton sculptor Boccaccio Sculpture Services. It features the golden retriever in his signature stance, holding a dual-ended flag in his mouth and facing marathon runners as they pass by. Powers said Spencer, a trained therapy dog that typically visited schools, hospitals, and other buildings during the week, began gaining more attention following the marathon bombings in 2013. When he began holding a Boston Strong flag. And he went viral during the marathon's 2018 edition when he braved heavy rain to encourage runners navigating the treacherous weather. He was a therapy dog, and after the bombing, we stood with a Boston Strong flag, and the runners seemed to really like seeing him, Powers said. He loved to hold things in his mouth, and he was a special, special dog. He would just see the energy people have and be able to reverberate that energy back at the runners. Year after year, the runners would start to look for him on the route. Spencer became an icon, with the Boston Athletic Association recognizing him in 2022 as the official dog of the 126th Boston Marathon. He was a reminder to runners that they could beat the odds. In 2022, he beat cancer and was still able to be out on the route, Powers said. On several occasions, we thought he wasn't going to be with us, and he became a symbol of hope for runners that you can do more than you think you can. Spencer's close compatriot, Penny, died just 7 days after Spencer last year. But a new golden retriever, Jimmy, will quite literally carry the flag for Spencer during this year's marathon on April 15th. The Boston Marathon route contains several statues, including one of the late running duo Dick and Rick Hoyt in Hopkinton, the famous starter statue at the Hopkinton starting line, and of marathon legend Johnny Kelly in Newton. When looking for a location for Spencer's statue, Powers said the town of Ashland did not want to put it on public property. But Robin and Cynthia Hicks, who live at 11 Franklin Road, dedicated a piece of their property to provide space for the statue, which the public is invited to visit. The Hicks family donated the space and were very thankful for their support, Powers said. Robin Hicks said he and his wife happened to be watching an Ashland Select Board meeting when the issue of putting the statue on public property was raised, which led to him getting in contact with Powers. We got in touch with Rich Powers and told him that we could use the space at the end of our driveway, which is right at the intersection of Franklin, Olive Street, and West Union Street, Hicks said. Hicks said he saw Spencer holding his flag each year during the marathon and was happy to volunteer the space. I patted him every year. He was such a good dog, he said. I tried to get my 3 dogs to behave like him, but they never could. I hope that people see the statue and it makes them think about doing something good for their community. Today's Ask Carolyn column is headlined, Single Parent Wants to Reconnect with Ex Who Didn't Want Kids. Dear Carolyn, my partner and I split after 12 years because he decidedly did not want children and I did. It was a terribly painful split, perhaps more so because it was completely loving and amicable. That was 7 years ago. Since then, I had a baby on my own. My ex met someone else, but they have also since split and she has moved away. We have had zero direct contact, but have so many mutual friends that we get updates about each other, so I know he's single now. The first years were difficult, but my amazing daughter is now doing great in kindergarten. My sister's family also moved nearby, and the cousin's sleepovers have given me the option of a night away. I can't stop thinking about calling the ex. The option of co-parenting is out, so we couldn't ever have more than a casual relationship. But I've met so few men I would want to date, even casually, and as a single parent, I have little time to go on lots of first dates. My former partner was so difficult to get over, but he was also my best friend for a long time. What should I do? Signed, the X-Files. Dear X-Files, I'll say carpe diem, get in touch, but only with a CVS receipt's worth of disclaimers, concerns, and caveats. Kid comes first. Let's say you settle all the other rekindling-related issues to your satisfaction. Will your amazing daughter be stuck with someone in your life who wants nothing to do with her? Weigh this carefully and long range. Kindergarten is a bit early to be fed that existential nugget. Other extreme. What if he teams with opinions on child rearing? Those rekindling-related issues include whether you still like him, he still likes you still want him, he still wants you, and there's any form of being together that includes living separately. One that makes you both feel so lucky things worked out this way, too, versus so tormented by what you still can't have. Not included, any form of the word casual. You may never marry, cohabit, or even see each other often for the next 15 to 20 years, but the feelings you do have, while you don't have all the other stuff, will probably be strong, which is why you're even thinking about him in the first place, remember. So don't kid yourself that the arm's-length living dating arrangements will come with arm's-length feelings. What-ifs are painful, which is why I almost can't help advising you that you should satisfy your curiosity. That and being a sucker for highly resilient best friend love. But most of the possible outcomes here involve trading pain for pain. I'm not saying you should kill the whole idea just because it might be painful. Love and personal growth tend to invite discomfort. I'm just saying to make sure you know what kind of discomfort you're inviting and be 100% ready for it, plus 10%. Did he suffer as you did from the breakup? If you even suspect he did, then be mindful of disrupting his peace of mind, too. You've initiated zero direct contact for 7 years. He hasn't called you either. Just putting that out there. If and only if it all passes the look test, then leap. Cape Cod Concert Band hosts free concert blending music and colors by Frankie Rowley of the Cape Cod Times. The Cape Cod Concert Band is helping people defrost from the winter and enter spring with its full spectrum musical colors to brighten your day concert at 2 p.m. on March 30th. Featuring songs such as Prince's Little Red Corvette and George Sweet's Black Light, the concert aims to combine the musical and the visual to incite a range of color-connected emotions within the audience. There's so many different pieces of music that reference a color, Tom Borning, conductor of the Cape Cod Concert Band, said. We tried to go around a lot of different colors, moods, and feelings. There's something for everybody in the concert, which is what we always try to do. With a 45-piece band made of volunteer musicians, Borning said that the show features a mix of unique instruments, such as the euphonium, and interesting musical accompaniments, such as a pretty rare duet between the bass clarinet and the baritone sax. I'm hoping people will hear some music they've never heard before, he said. They'll have some other music that will sound familiar to them, but done in a different way. I hope they'll hear some instruments that maybe they're not used to hearing and go, wow, that sounds great. Of the shows in the piece, Borning said he's particularly drawn to Black Light due to its minimalism and uniqueness. However, he said that due to the personal nature of the songs, each orchestra member would probably give a different piece to look out for, including Kate Woolley, president and publicist and flute player for the Cape Cod Concert Band. I have a fondness for a little piece called Yellow, which is part of a larger suite that was written for a little girl who had a very rare form of cancer, Hooley explained. She color-coded her days. A yellow day was a joyful, happy, and good day. It's a simple little tune, and yet it just builds, and there's this part where the instruction of the musician, I think it says, with joy, and it's written so that it actually feels joyful at that moment. The Cape Cod Concert Band's full spectrum musical colors to brighten your day is free. The show begins at 2 p.m. on March 30th inside the Knight Auditorium at Barnstable High School on West Main Street in Hyannis. For more information about the show, visit capecodconcertband.org. Here are some other things to know that are happening on the Cape. Falmouth Easter Stroll. Falmouth Village's annual Easter Stroll is set to take place from 1 to 3 p.m. on March 30th. Participating stores will hand out Easter candy to guests wandering along Main Street. Cape Symphony Orchestra performs Bartok and Poulenc during Better Together concert. The Cape Symphony Orchestra will perform selected works of Béla Bartók and Francis Poulenc during its Better Together concerts on April 6th and 7th. Bartók's Concerto for Orchestra and Poulenc's Concerto for Two Pianos join Gordon Jacobs' Old Wine in New Bottles on the concert's program. The symphony will be led by guest conductor Francisco Noya, music director of the Boston Civic Symphony Orchestra and part of the conducting faculty at the Berklee College of Music, and accompanied by guest pianists Christina and Michelle Naughton. Better Together has two show times, 7:30 p.m. on April 6th and 3 p.m. on April 7th. Performances will take place at the Barnstable Performing Arts Center on West Main Street in Hyannis. Tickets for the show range from $32 to $72 for adults and $16 to $32 for students aged 16 to 22. For more information about the show or to purchase tickets, visit the Cape Symphony's website. Professor Ronald Bierce gives talk on communications infrastructure at Chatham Marconi Maritime Center. Massachusetts Maritime Academy Professor Ronald Bierce is giving a talk on the importance of strengthening our communications infrastructure at 7 p.m. on April 4th at the Chatham Marconi Maritime Center. With over 20 years of experience in emergency management and infrastructure security, Bierce will use his wealth of knowledge to go over the necessity of having a strong and protected national communications infrastructure to avoid cyber attacks and other threats to our security. Registration for the event is $10, and participants can attend in person or over Zoom. To register for the event or for more information, visit chathammarconi.org. The Chatham Marconi Maritime Center is located at 831 Orleans Road in Chatham. Applications open for 2024 Snack Shack program at Hyannis Harbor Overlook. The town of Barnstable is currently accepting applications from food vendors for its 2024 Snack Shack program. The program, which runs from June to November, gives budding and established culinary businesses the chance to rent out the Snack Shack, located on Hyannis Harbor Overlook across from the High Arts Artist Shanties, for 6 days at a time. The process of applying is simple. Applicants must submit a Snack Shack application and submit a Town of Barnstable temporary food permit application once their dates are assigned. Applicants can request to rent the shack for multiple weeks. However, they may only request to rent for up to 4 consecutive weeks. Alongside filling out forms, applicants must also pay a $50 fee for the temporary food service permit each week they rent the shack and a $150 refundable security deposit. There is no rental fee for the shack, and the town of Barnstable provides basic equipment, a commercial-grade fridge and workspace, a display fridge and freezer, a sink and hand-washing station, and a microwave for the shack. For more information about the program or to submit an application, visit businessbarnstable.com. Locally owned South Shore burger chain named Best in State by David R. Smith of the Patriot Ledger. Kakady's Burger Bar can't seem to keep itself out of the headlines lately, and that's a good thing. Just a few weeks after its burgers were ranked among the best in Massachusetts by the group Taste of Massachusetts, the South Shore and Cape Cod restaurant chain's burgers and fries were named the best in the state by the website Love Food, which has a state-by-state list. The site highlighted a few of Kady's offerings of note. The Vermonter, with caramelized apples and onions, smoked bacon, Vermont cheddar, and maple mayo, is a hit. Or you can go all out with the award-winning Rock and its four patties, pile of bacon, American cheese, onion rings, and special sauce, the site said. While the coleslaw is good, the fries are the must-try side. Love Food said its selections are based on genuine user reviews, awards, and accolades, and the first-hand experience of our team. They're also regularly checked and updated. Hungry yet? Here are Kakady's Burger Bar locations. The restaurant's first location opened in downtown Plymouth in 2010. The business has since expanded to locations in Marshfield and Hyannis, along with its express locations in Manomet and Southern Plymouth, Plimpton, and West Bridgewater. The Plymouth location relocated last year to the site of a long-closed Papagino's, a little up the road from its original. What's up with the extra K in Kady's? They named it Kakady's after a World War I song co-owner Keith Stiding liked that Katie McSorley's father used to sing to her. These days, the name represents their partnership, with K for Keith meshed with McSorley's name. Cape Cod Pizza Shark owner in Early Bird, now streaming on Apple TV, by Gwen Friss of the Cape Cod Times. It's been quite a month for Cape Cod actor Josh Koopman and the crew at Pizza Shark Cape Cod, which he co-owns with his wife, Sarah Scanavan Koopman, and friend Todd Montgomery. It's been a wild 3 weeks, but you just have to ride the wave when it's happening, he said. The actor-slash-pizza guy filled us in on the whirlwind. On Tuesday, Koopman's latest film, the indie comedy Early Bird, became available on Amazon Prime, Peacock, Apple TV, and other streaming services. Commercials are scheduled for TV spots during The Tonight Show, starring Jimmy Fallon and Access Hollywood. The movie had its world premiere in 2023 at the Milwaukee Film Festival and IFF Boston. The movie trailer can be seen on YouTube. The Milwaukee Festival's description said, Early Bird tells the story of a struggling theater owner as he tries to resuscitate his business with increasingly outlandish play productions. A meditation on creative careers and the potential for passion to fizzle out. This fictional film will hit close to home and serve as a glimmer of hope for arts patrons and workers alike. On April 3rd at 7 p.m., the 90-minute Early Bird will have a one-night cake premiere on new projection equipment at the Chatham Orpheum, which houses one of Pizza Shark's three locations. The others are the original at Pleasant Lake in Harwich and now one in Dennis. None of my staff have seen the movie yet, and they'll be at the premiere. I'm terrified, he confided. Early Bird is about a small community theater troupe trying to fill seats while staging quality shows to maintain their integrity as actors. But it becomes a comedy of errors when the down-and-out actors stage a joke play that is a smash hit, and their leader, played by Koopman, lets it go to his head. Koopman, an Army veteran who turned to acting and whose movies include The Golden Scallop with fellow Cape Codder Marley Schulenberg and How to Rob, said he tries to envision the feature-length film in its totality, so that when scenes are filmed out of order, he still has a strong hold on where he wants his character to be. In a lot of ways, Early Bird is a love letter to that desire to do good work, Koopman said. My level of panic comes from not wanting to let the other actors down. Community theater is at the heart of Pizza Shark, since Koopman and many of the other folks, Trish LaRose, Jared Hagen, Holly Aaron McCarthy, Anthony Texera, and Jess Andra, who work there are veteran Cape actors. Although their availability is limited in summer, Koopman said they're a great team because they're incredible people, smiling and talented. Early Bird was filmed in less than a month in Milwaukee. Koopman said it got a boost after Good Deed Entertainment picked up the film, written and directed by Martin Kazabowski. Coincidentally, Pizza Shark's animated commercial, created by Koopman's Barnstable High School acting teacher John Sullivan and shown during Boston Celtics games, went viral on X, hitting 775,000 views on the site formerly known as Twitter. Also, the Cape Cod pizza business saw a big bump in demand for its merchandise after White Lotus actress Megan Fahey wore a Pizza Shark sweatshirt while revealing her relationship with actor Leo Woodall after a year of Are They or Aren't They social media flirting. Fahey's Instagram post was in People.com, Vogue, Glamour magazine, and Page Six. She's walking with her back to the camera and wearing our cobalt sweatshirt, Koopman said. The cobalt blue sold out immediately when Pizza Shark started getting 36 online orders a week for shirts and hats. It's a cool secondary revenue stream, Koopman said, noting that acting and pizza work well together. I don't audition anymore. I figure if I'm in a room with 50 guys who look like me, one of the other 49 can probably do it better, he said. My great freedom is that I'm only making movies with people I love and stories I'm interested in. I'll end today with another poem that was apparently misprinted in last week's paper. We'll read it in its entirety today. It's by Deanna J. Baxter, who grew up in Lexington, Kentucky, moved to New England, returned to the South, graduated from Western Illinois University, and retired to Maine. She and her husband and Scottish Terrier live in Yarmouthport. Baxter enjoyed a long career in education and has published a collection of short stories dealing with individuals navigating through the autumn and winter seasons of life. Her inspiration for the poem: we were camping in Maine, and while walking our dog in the woods, I came upon an isolated family plot of graves. I was struck by one grave of a woman who lived 82 years. In the rugged environment of Maine, what strength to survive she must have shown to her family. And the poem is titled Unknown Identified. The tall birches guard the mountain, and the sunlight dispels long shadows, tracking a scattering of graves, each with etched stones. They cling to the mountain, absorbing the earth and sun, like a family reunion picnic, sharing memories when the big meal is done. The etched letters on stone converse, tales told of life on earth. One stone sits, apart wearing moss like a worn overcoat. Letters peep through buttonholes of moss, the caption made plain. Living 82 springs, she died when the heavy snows came. Traces of an identity, 1803 to 1885, a span of time unknown. She, like the split birch close by, overcame barriers, expanding the limits to survive. Each year, her heavy moss coat is soaked by the warm rain. Surviving the heavy snows, she now awaits the birth of a new spring. And that's all I have time for today. This is your reader, Libby, saying thank you for listening.